cell, it's called Halothiobacillus neapolitanus, a bacterial cell. You can see some storage granules inside. I don't think anyone's shown a tilt series yet, so that's the purpose of this. This is the one time we'll actually show the primary data from tomography. This is a tilt series of this cell. And if we then do a reconstruction, a three-dimensional reconstruction of this cell, I picked it because it's so rich in ultrastructure. You're seeing these large objects come up. These are called carboxysomes. And they are responsible for a significant fraction of all the carbon fixation going on in the world. And so you see these carboxysomes, you see these storage granules, you see cytoskeletal filaments on the top surface of the cell. Here's a long set of cytoskeletal filaments. Later on, there's another bundle of filaments, a different kind, that twist right here along the carboxysomes. Another structure is that you'll notice a carboxysome is right next to a storage granule, and there's actually an interesting protein structure that connects the two. Okay, so the bottom line is that structures in cells are heterogeneous, and there is going to be information about them that the right way to obtain it is by tomography. You can study these things in isolation, in purification, but there's more to be learned about things once you get them, once you view them inside the cell. So we made this little movie of the segmentation. We go through that cell, and now we'll start segmenting pieces of it. We're going to segment the carboxysomes. They were of particular interest in this study, but we'll also show the storage granules are coming up in the segmentation. Another thing of interest, now we're laying over the membranes on it. You know, for a while, people thought that bacteria were just bags of enzymes. And so it turns out that there's quite a bit of complex structure to them. Here, we're highlighting that the membrane isn't just a bag. It has complicated invaginations here. And so in order to increase the surface area of the membrane, it elaborates these invaginations. And they seem to be interacting with the storage granules. Another thing we found here is there's these bodies internal to carboxysomes. We'll focus more on that later. Oh, I hope this isn't the version where we... Oh, it is. Sorry about that. We looked inside, and then we thought, that's not useful. So the second version, we just cut that out. There's nothing to see in there anyway. It's just an invagination. But one never knows when you first make the movie. Okay, now we're going to highlight this filament. Now, this is a tube, believe it or not. There are tubular structures in bacteria. And if we pan up and down through this tube, you can see that it kind of closes off on the back side, and then it closes off on the front side. If we segment an isosurface of that part of the density and look at it, the missing wedge prevents us from seeing a nice, beautiful closed tube, but nevertheless, it's compellingly a tube. Now, here's a filament bundle that's likely MREB coming from the pole of the cell. These cells, bacteria, are amazing because they establish polarity and they generate unique shapes. So this filament bundle is really hard to see. Oh, ribosomes. So we are going to talk about ribosomes. Here's a set of ribosomes. We didn't learn anything about them from this, but here they are. And now we're going to look. Here's this internal granule inside a carboxysome. And now we're going to focus on this interesting protein matrix in between the carboxysome and the storage granule. This was completely unsuspected. And as people work hard to model exactly how the carboxysome does its biochemistry, I think it's going to matter that it's intimately connected to this storage granule. And what the storage granule is, we don't know. So tomography contributes part of the story, not the whole thing. Now, here's another illustration of what tomography can do. It had been a question. So these carboxysomes are protein shells, kind of like viruses. And then they pack themselves with the enzyme Rubisco. And so it looks like a little machine where you concentrate substrate and enzyme all together. And because of that, you dramatically increase the throughput of that reaction pathway. So you pack substrate and enzyme together. But it had been a mystery, how do you actually assemble a carboxysome and then pack it with Rubisco? Do you assemble the shell and then try to import Rubiscos? Or do you have Rubiscos collect in a ball and then you put a shell around it? Or maybe do you make a shell and then put a ribosome inside and create rubiscos inside? Nobody knew. And tomography helped us because here's a partial carboxysome. We were able to put cells in conditions where they're assembling carboxysomes as fast as they can. And this now we'll show that this is a partial carboxysome. What we were able to see is that it's already packing full of rubiscos. So the process is simultaneous, and I'll show you even clearer examples, but as the shell assembles, it's already being packed full of rubiscos. And so that's kind of a summary tour of a cell and the role of tomography in it. The DNA here is not visible. So the DNA is likely not highly structured, like the last picture I showed you. And it's probably, most of it must be supercoiled. That's what the biochemistry says. And in many cells, you get the distinct impression that the ribosomes are clustered around the periphery, and there's a central region with a different texture. And I think that's the nucleoid. And the DNA is pushing the ribosomes to the outside, but we don't actually see strands. But in some cells, you do see strands. Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's about a micron and a half long, and it's about 500 nanometers diameter.
And how about the thickness? Is it flattened?
Not significantly. So it's about 500 nanometers. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's story number one to illustrate the role of cellular tomography. And we're still on the question, are things in cells heterogeneous? So story number two, I think all of us say, yes, they're heterogeneous, but story number two, to prove that we're right, is about this protein that causes cell division in bacteria. It's called FTSZ. It's a tubulin homolog, so here it is, FTSZ, and if you put a YFP tag on it and then look at it in cells that are beginning to divide, you get this little ring around the mid cell, and so people started imagining how FTSZ might be driving cell constriction. I won't tell the whole story, but here is one of the most important pieces of data we got. When we did tomography of dividing cells, we could see this FTSZ filament and show that it was FTSZ with a bunch of controls. But here's an example. Here's an inner membrane of the cell. By the way, that's the outer membrane. And this cell type is Colobacter crescentis, and here's a surface layer of protein on the outside. And it's these filaments that are just inside the inner membrane that are FTSZ. So here it seems to be connected to the inner membrane and then have a region. And one of the most important things we saw in these tomograms was that sometimes the filaments had these straight segments, like this one, and this one looks pretty straight. And then oftentimes, though, they were very gently curved. So here's one that's gently curved across this whole region. And from in vitro studies, it had been known that FTSZ, in the presence of GTP, it's a GTPase, like tubulin, in the presence of GTP, it likes to be straight. And in the presence of GDP, it likes to be curved. And so seeing inside of a cell, sometimes curved, sometimes straight. You don't see spirals. No, they're actually just short arcs. And that was another part of the, because you're interested, I'll tell some more of this story. When people saw the LM images like this, I think everybody imagined that FTSZ probably formed a ring, and there would be some motor protein here that would drive one strand against the other, and that's how you do constriction. And this predicts a lot of things. One is that we would someday find a motor that drove across FTSZ. Another is that you'd have complete rings. And also at the beginning of division, you might have one ring, and at the end of division, you might have a whole spiral. And what we saw, and sorry, I jettisoned the slide, but what we saw is that there were arcs, short filament stretches inside cells, but they weren't complete rings. And they were sometimes straight, and they were sometimes curved. And our interpretation, the working hypothesis, is that the filaments get loaded with GTP and form a straight filament that hits the side of the wall, the cell membrane. And then through GTP hydrolysis, that generates the force to go curved, and that curving action has a slight pinching effect on the membrane. And then FTSE is also a scaffold for peptidoglycan synthetic enzymes. So all along FTSE, you have enzymes that build the cell wall behind the cell. And once you've built the cell wall in, then the filament itself can depolymerize, and the progress isn't just immediately relaxed. It stays there. Then it depolymerizes, reloads with GTP, forms a straight filament, and goes again. And so we imagine bacterial cell constriction to be an iterative process, the sum of thousands of little pinching events. And this, yeah.
Those filaments, whether they're straight or curved,
yeah.
With one single filament, or is there a thickness to it that changes with curvature?
No, they were always protofilaments. But it nicely dovetails with some of the results your group has obtained, where seeing microtubule protofilaments, tubulin protofilaments, after they hydrolyze GTP and curl out, if that actually generates force to move that DAM1 ring, that's the same. It's analogous that GTP hydrolysis could actually produce force in this other tubulin homolog in bacteria through that transition from straight to curved. So I've been telling the story for a couple years now, so I apologize. A lot of you have heard it. And if you want more details, we can talk later. But the overall point is that seeing heterogeneity in cells is often or can be the key to understanding what's going on. Straight versus curved is the key. So we should embrace the heterogeneity that happens inside cells, and we should try to learn something about it by tomography. And so it'll have a role to play in addition with single particle analysis and all other techniques. Yeah, David?
Your curved filament is, in the example that you show, the curved one is 3 or 4 or 5 times longer than your straight snake.
Yeah.
Is that a general rule, or is that just what you're showing us here?
No, the straight segments are usually just are shorter parts of it. So, and the straight segments seem to often have kinks, where they'll be straight for a little while and they kink. So maybe that's one of the reasons they appear shorter. I imagine if you had a filament that was 3 straight segments and then it all hydrolyzed and went curved, then it would look like one big continuous curve. That's what I would guess, but I haven't looked at that real carefully. Okay, the next question we want to address together is 40 angstrom data useful? And I hope we would all vote a resounding yes. So let's see if we can prove it to ourselves. It is useful, but it's not the world, of course. So the story I want to tell to try to prove this one is about bacterial chemotaxis. And let me just introduce it to you. Bacteria know where to swim, and that's because they have chemoreceptors in the surface of their surface. And as they bind ligands, either attractants or repellents, these receptors cause signaling molecules to be either phosphorylated or not. The signaling molecules go over to the flagellar motors, and they bind to part of it, and they tell the flagellar motor whether to turn clockwise or counterclockwise. And for at least E. coli has several motors on its surface. And if all of them are being told to spin the same direction, all these flagella coil up behind the cell, and it moves forward. If, however, the chemoreceptors change the phosphorylation state of the signaling molecule, and it causes all the motors to turn the other direction, in the other direction, the natural curvature of their flagella causes them to instead splay out, and they just uselessly tumble, is what it's called. And they change direction. So this is how bacteria know where to swim. So this is, some people have studied this as a simple example of behavior. Wouldn't it be great if we could, you know, dissect the molecular basis of behavior? But we can't do it in us. We're way too complicated. So this is an example of a simple behavior that we can get our hands on the molecules involved. So this is what drives intense interest in bacterial chemotaxis. So we have crystal structures of some of these receptors. We have crystal structures of lots of pieces here. People model this. Their whole labs are devoted to computer modeling of how this circuit works and how it would be affected. And what's and lots of experiments are being done. And what's come out of this work, and one part has come out, is that the extreme sensitivity of the system is due in part to cooperativity between these receptors. In other words, if you turn one receptor on, a lot of the other receptors get turned on too. And the other marvel of the system is that it can change, it has a gain knob, and so it can change the gain that it responds to. So as it swims up a gradient of food, it stays hypersensitive no matter what level it's living in at the time. So how does that work is quite a mystery. So like I said, we have crystal structures of some of the receptors. Here's it was crystallized in pieces, but it's so important that, you know, people went after the pieces one by one. And then they started proposing models. So the crystal structure of these receptors, the receptors appear in dimers. Each receptor is has two alpha helices. And so a dimer is a four helical bundle. And then in the crystal structure from E. coli, this little orange ball represents one receptor dimer. And they crystallized as a trimer of receptor dimers. So three right next to each other. And there's these other molecules called key A and key W, which are known to bind to the system. And so it was proposed from the crystal structure that chemoreceptors arrange themselves like this in a hexagonal lattice. And the hexagons would be 20 nanometers apart. And so this is the model people were working with. Then the next receptor that crystallized was from Thermotoga maritima. And here they crystallized as dimers. So you have that stable four helix bundle. But in the crystal structure, there were rows of these receptor dimers. So then a new model emerged that maybe that's the organization. And so it matters a lot, because how do you generate cooperativity in this mode? How would this receptor turning on it? You could see that it would turn these on, but how is it going to affect these? Is that through some other proteins? Here you could see it could turn on a whole row. And so it mattered a lot what the architecture was, but nobody could get their hands on this, because it actually, the best way to do it is by tomography. So we've now started imaging lots of different bacteria, and lots of them have chemoreceptor arrays. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about how we identified them as chemoreceptor arrays. But here's a cell, for instance. And here, this line, that distance off the inner membrane, that's what chemoreceptor arrays look like. They all pack together, and there they are. And so this slide is showing that in 13 different species, we found these chemoreceptor arrays now. And here's another set of cells where we found the chemoreceptor arrays. See, they all look the same. They're these, from the side view, they look like lines a certain distance inside the inner membrane. Here's another set. Okay, so we have tomograms of all these, and the point is that if you look at them from the top, so now we're going to roll that over and look at it from the top, you see this nice hexagonal lattice. And I guess we're not showing the power spectrum of this one. But in all these other panels, these are the top views of chemoreceptors from lots of different bacteria. Here are all their power spectra. And the bottom line is that they're all the same hexagonal packing. It's a 12 nanometer spacing. So they all look like this. And our molecular interpretation is that you have trimers that form the vertices here. And it turns out that if you put the crystal structure in there, here we'll put the crystal structure to scale, it fits very nicely at each vertex. So even though we don't actually see those molecules, it's a compelling case that the bacterial chemoreceptor array is a hexagonal lattice of trimers of receptor dimers, and it's clear that they could now communicate throughout the whole lattice. If this one kicks on, by the way, one of the hypotheses for how these turn on is that if a ligand binds on top, they kick out like they have some kind of knee structure. And so you can imagine if there's one right here and this one kicks, that one might kick and it might kick this one, and like dominoes, turn them all on. And the propensity to kick can be modulated by methylation up at the top, and this is known from biochemical work. And so now we have at least working hypotheses for the molecular basis for this cooperativity. And then other people have discovered the methylation story, which is a molecular mechanism for adjusting the gain of the whole system. So, and it's interesting that that structure is, that architecture is universally conserved throughout bacteria. Everyone we've ever looked at that have chemoreceptor arrays, it looks like this. So this is the punchline to answer the question, is 40 angstrom data useful? And I'm going to try to say yes, because in some cases it's exactly what's needed to go from the crystal structures to actually get a molecular mechanism. Please, question back there. Great. Thanks, great question. Let me hold it for a second. We will get to that, but I'm just wondering if I should do it right now. But I had another question first. Let's see what yours was. Great, same question. Let's do it.
Okay. So the whole story is... Don't worry. I always carry a bunch of slides we're not going to get to just in case we get the question. I know how much time we have. But where is that one? Oh, here it is. Okay.
So, at the beginning, Arianna Brigel, people from Max Planck will recognize her name, Arianna Brigel, who I think is the first one that I'm aware of that started putting immunolabels on chemoreceptors. So she had plastic sections with immunolabels that showed that this cluster was labeling with antibodies to chemoreceptors. Then a lot more work in that direction was done in Sriram Subramanian's group. They did a lot of great immunolabeling to show that that structure picked up the antibody labels. In addition, they overexpressed chemoreceptors in cells, and they saw that same structure that I pointed to, all of a sudden it was all over the place. It was vastly larger. So these are actually principles in answer to one of the questions. How do you identify a structure in tomography? One, there was this immunolabeling that helped. Another is to change the abundance of the structure. If you overexpress it and you see a lot more of that, that's a clue. If you deplete the cells for that and it's gone, that's a clue. If you change the stability of something, that's one of the ways we proved that filament was FTSC, is we made a mutation in FTSC that slowed the hydrolysis rate of GTP. And what we saw in the cells is that then the filaments were much longer. And if you overexpress it, they become vastly more abundant. So you can tweak things and then see if that's reflected in the images. But we were able to take another step and contribute another, you know, piece of evidence that these really are the chemoreceptors with correlated light and electron microscopy. So that's what I mean by this, correlated fluorescence light microscopy and electron cryotomography. So what Arianna did is, our collaborators introduced the M-Cherry tag onto chemoreceptors. And so the challenge was to get cells to stick onto EM grids firmly, so that we could take a picture in the light microscope and then move it into the EM and get a picture of the same cells because they haven't moved on the grid. So first, we tried lots of things. The one thing we tried that ended up almost working was coating the grid with polylysine. And if you take a wild-type Colobacter cell, they'll stick these polylysine-coated grids, but it seemed like the polylysine was so grippy that they would rip the cells apart and just peel the membrane down so it would stick. So the cells were damaged badly, but they would stick to that polylysine-coated grid. So then the next thing we tried is lightly fixing the cells so they would have more integrity and then sticking them to the grid by polylysine. And that's what we did here. That seemed to work. It kept most of their structure intact, but not all of it. For instance, see these defects in the surface layer? Oh, this outer membrane? These defects? This arises when you lightly fix cells. So these are not perfect condition. But nevertheless, the chemoreceptor arrays, they maintain their structure. So once we had them strengthened and stuck to the EM grid, we could put that in a fluorescent light microscope between a cover slip and a glass slide. And we could use a 100x oil immersion lens and take a very high resolution light microscope picture of a field of cells. And in that field of cells, here's the whole of a quantifoil grid. And here's a colobacter cell hanging into the hole, and that's where the fluorescence was. In this cell, here's the colobacter cell, and there's the fluorescence. Then we could very gently peel off the cover slip, and that's a traumatic event, I think, for the to the grid, but lots of fields of cells made it through that. Peeling off the cover slip, then we'd take the EM grid, we'd add another drop of buffer just so the VitroBot would work better. We plunged frozen in the VitroBot, got into the EM, found the same region of cells, and then we got tomograms of some of the same cells. So here's a tomogram of that cell, and it shows that the chemoreceptor array is in the same position as the fluorescence. Here's another example where here's the chemoreceptor array at the pole, and there's our fluorescence. Now, we could also use a mutant. The chemoreceptor array is at the pole in wild-type cells, but we can use a mutant where the chemoreceptor array is put somewhere else, and the fluorescence would always match. Wherever the fluorescence was, that's where that structure was. So the case is now pretty darn strong. There's immunolabeling, there's expression perturbations, there's correlated light in EM, there's so that's, but it's hard, huh? Oh, that's a lot of stuff. It's unfortunate it took that much work to really make a strong case that that's the chemoreceptor array, but that's where we are. All right, so 40 angstrom data is useful for some things, but it's not for everything. My next story about 40 angstrom data being useful is from viruses. And this also illustrates a point we're going to go towards, which is how do you average subtomograms to get higher signal-to-noise ratio. So this, our lab has kind of gone into now two areas, bacterial ultrastructure and also the structure of HIV is another field that's really crying out for tomographic data. And so in this project, we did, oh, that's my cell phone, right by the microphone thing. So this is tomography of immature viruses, and you don't need to know the whole story. But immature HIV viruses are spherical, and they have these layers of protein, and we'd like to understand those layers. By the way, there's crystal structures for everything in HIV, but you know, and there have been, and there's actually thousands of crystal structures of some of the HIV proteins, and yet we still don't know how they fit together. So that's part of our story. Crystallography is not everything. It also helps to have a tomogram of how these pieces fit together. So as we're going through, do you see a hexagonal layer? There's a little hexagonal layer on the surface. And that'll be borne out later in some of the segmentations. The protein is called GAG, and it just goes into the membrane, and it's arranged radially in from the membrane. Mark Yeager's with us, and it's his group that really first showed that a long time ago. But what we saw in the tomograms is that the GAG protein seemed to be found in sectors on the inside the virus instead of completely. The next thing we could do is we could recognize layers. There's a nucleocapsid, there's the C-terminus of capsid, there's the N-terminus of capsids, and then there's a layer called the matrix layer. And in our tomograms, what we did is projected all the density in a layer out onto a surface, and we were interested in which layer mediates this hexagonal packing. So we project the density out onto those layers, and then computationally we can dissect the virus. So here we'll dissect it. This is the matrix layer. This is the N-terminus of capsid, C-terminus of capsid, and the nucleocapsid. And what you see is that there's a hexagonal packing in the N-terminus of capsid and the C-terminus. This is a hole, but it'll come around. There's no packing evident, no order evident in nucleocapsid or the matrix layer. But here, okay, we're coming around to another region where there's order in the C-terminus. So now we'll take an ordered layer, and what we could do is identify all the peaks of the density. And what we notice is that in some areas where the GAG is, they're nicely ordered in a hexagonal lattice. In other areas where there's no GAG, it's really messy. There is no real order there. So we'd like to average things and get to a higher signal-to-noise ratio. So the next thing we did is we quantified by how hexagonally packed each unit cell was. We found some that were very nicely hexagonal and others that were horribly not hexagonal at all. And we duplicated the reconstruction for every nicely hexagonally packed unit cell. We translated it and rotated it to superimpose just the nice unit cells there. We produced an average, and voila, there's the average. So that gives us a higher signal-to-noise version of a unit cell in that GAG lattice. And it turns out that so much is known about these proteins already that that was sufficient to propose a pseudo-atomic model. And I should qualify that and say, I don't mean that we know exactly how the proteins are twisted with respect to each other. But we're going to get to the bottom line here, which is that in the density, the 40 angstrom feature in the density that meant everything was that we saw underneath the C-terminus of capsid, we saw tubes of density that were the size that you'd expect for a bundle of alpha helices. There's six molecules around these. That was already known. And there was in vitro data that suggested that this little spacer called SP1 liked to form helices. And so when we saw a tube of density consistent with a bundle of alpha helices, our interpretation was that this spacer does, in fact, form an alpha helix, and they form a bundle. And that's what holds these clusters, these hexagons of capsid together. So we can move from that now into, here's how we tell that story in this movie. Here's a tomogram of an immature virus, and this is about HIV maturation. So now we'll go from that tomogram to a molecular interpretation. And these are the GAG molecules with their different layers. So there's the matrix and the N-terminus of capsid, C-terminus, and then this key spacer. Protease comes in, and we know where protease clips. It clips off the nucleocapsid. It clips off here between matrix and capsid. And eventually, it also clips between this spacer and that molecule. So there's two triggers that allow this lattice to mature. One is it gets cut off at the top. And the other is that it gets cut off at the bottom. And both hold it in certain patterns. Once you cut off that little bundle of helices at the bottom, we believe that it can now flex and to change its conformation actually fall apart. And when it's cut off from the top, the crystal structures have already shown that there's a refolding event and this hairpin forms at the end terminus, that this new hairpin is actually the key contact that nucleates a different hexagonal lattice. And then it can go on to mature to form the mature state. And actually, the best structures of this mature state of these lattices are also from Mark Jaeger's group. He's been doing 2D crystallography of these. So now this part of the animation is embarrassing. But the idea is that then these new hexamers would come together to form the cone shape that's seen in mature virus. Okay, and so just, I don't know. So you don't want to cut off in the middle of that since it's a lot of action. But that's not really how it happens. But the bottom line here and the story that we want to tell is that in a tomogram, seeing that there's this tube of density underneath the capsid lattice was everything. It wasn't everything. It was an important part of this of recognizing that the triggers that drive maturation would be if you clip those off, then all of a sudden the monomers would be free to diffuse around. And so seeing that 40 angstrom tube of density, or 40 angstrom resolution tube of density, was really important for HIV biology. And so let's conclude that 40 angstrom data is, in fact, useful. Please. No, sorry. What we see is that there's often a clump of material in the base of that cone. When the capsid forms a cone, there's a clump of material down there. And so we interpret that to be the nuclear protein particle. But we've never seen any structure inside of it. No indication of the kissing complex or anything. So we don't know more about that. Sorry about it. Now, I imagine that a lot of us would say, what else is the contribution? What else can we use tomography to do? One of the things would be, can we generate initial models of heterogeneous complexes to feed into single particle refinements? And people have been saying this a lot. Does anybody know of an example where this has been done? Please. Awesome.
About 10 years ago, at least.
Okay, great. So you can, thank you for helping me. So it's clearly, there's a good chance that you could generate a nice initial model for your complex by doing tomography first. I just couldn't cite a bunch of examples. So there it is. That's another use of 40 angstrom data.
I also
did it. Oh, okay, Paul tried it. Yeah, so why don't we have more examples? Well, for our excuse is that as soon as we started taking tomograms of cells, we just had like a million things to look at, and we just started doing that. And so I think it's entirely possible. It's just sometimes people that are invested into tomography get diverted, and so it's not what we typically use. Eva, comment. So let's go to that part. I'm going to answer that question a little bit more fully. I'm going to use it as my intro to a different question, but I will certainly go through that in detail. And that is one of the questions I was asked to address, can larger data sets, larger numbers of tomograms be obtained? And what new problems does this create if you have larger number of tomograms? So we, in collaboration with Dave Agard and Sean Zhang at UCSF, and also the Legenon team here, implemented a version of UCSF TOMO, which is this predictive tilt series acquisition protocol. We implemented that within Legenon. So now we can put in a grid, we can get an overview atlas of our grid. This one was one of our first ones, and unfortunately has a rip in the carbon, and I just haven't switched the slide yet. But this is what bacterial cells look like. They hold a bunch of water around them, and so we can look at an overview grid, and we pick which cells we want tomograms of, and we also identify a focus spot in its vicinity but away from it to do some of the manipulation. And then after that, you can leave. And now Legenon goes to the first target. It goes off-site, off of that target, and it resets the eucentric height, it resets the focus, it centers the energy slit. For us, it double-checks the dose rate that's coming off of the tip, the electron gun, and then it goes back onto the sample and it does UCSF TOMO collecting a tilt series. And then when it's done, then it moves the stage over to the next target in your queue and does all of those starting procedures and then takes the next tilt series. And it took a long time to make this robust, but that team that I just identified achieved it. And so now we're getting sometimes 30 or 40 tomograms a day. And I just had to write a grant about this, so I asked for the statistics. We did 4,000 in the last 6 months. So we collected 4,000 bacterial tomograms in the last 6 months, and we were down most of August. So it is a boatload of data now. And so now the rate-limiting step is, how do you process all that? Because we're not going to click all those beads. And fortunately, Mark Horowitz and a fellow working with him, Fernando Amat at Stanford, got interested in developing a program for automatic tilt series reconstruction. They called it Raptor. And also there's some facilities like that in iMod that David Mastronardi has built in. But Raptor, we've actually been able to tune it, so it's totally automatic. It knows what size gold beads we use, and we don't have to do anything. It finds the gold beads, it aligns the tilt series, and produces the reconstruction all by itself. So now we just send that out, and it keeps up with a microscope now. So then our next problem was, where are we going to put all these? Because everybody had 8 external hard drives on their computer, and I worried, you know, what happens when Ariana leaves? You know, I'm toast. Where I don't even know where all this data is. So, because our lab is only 7 years old, so we just started hitting these problems 3 or 4 years ago of people actually leaving. So we wrote this database. And the database, I really like it. We call it the Caltech. It's called the Caltech Tomography Database, but in our lab we call it the Jensen Lab Database. But it's going to be it's going to be distributed, and anybody who wants it is going to be able to download it. We're preparing that publication now, but it's meant to look like YouTube. And so each tomogram has its own video, and it has a snapshot showing what it is, and then you click on this and you get the little video of it. And you can sort it by the specimen or the user or what publication that data went into. You can sort it by like the most popular, like YouTube, because you know, some are just nobody ever looks at. They're boring. And some, everybody's always looking at them. And so here they are, and it has, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of tomograms in it now. And so this is what we've got. By the way, there's another database that might serve the same function, which is the cell-centered database. We tried. It was a little bit more too sophisticated for us. The databases had to come back and talk to disks in San Diego, and it was too complex for us. So we built a simple one just for us. But this may be useful to people who are doing a lot of tomography. You might want to do this. And so Legenon, right now we're working with the Legenon team to make a node so that Legenon, after it collects the tilt series, it launches Raptor, and then it deposits the results in the database. And so now you'd insert a grid, you'd click the cells you want, and the next day you come back to tomograms. And we can also append into it the first level image processing, like finding the cell and some denoising or something like that. Okay, so that's our situation. So then Ava says, why don't you make this public? And the first reason is a little bit selfish. For instance, this analysis of chemoreceptor arrays, we published one paper about chemoreceptor arrays in Colobacter, saying it was this 12 nanometer hexagonal lattice. And then we realized, you know, let's just check if it's 12 nanometer hexagonal lattice in all the other bacteria. So we went back to our tomograms, and we didn't collect any more data at all. We just processed them, and it's the same 12 nanometer lattice everywhere. And I'm going to jump to the next part of that story, which is flagellar motors.
But Grant, you know, I think that part of Amy's question was, you know, just like the PPE inside, so there should be public repositories for this data, so that other labs can mine it as well, and not just, you know, I mean, presumably once you make a publication of the tomogram, then there's no reason why it should be available to the larger public to then try to mine for other interesting things. Because you're not going to, you know, no matter how prolific your lab is, you're not going to be able to mine everything that's in every single one of your tomograms in a finite time period.
Yeah.
Someone would be very interested. So it is much more like sequence than data. It's less likely that you
Some of these Bridget. Sound like really good questions for the panel. So, I know you have, well, there's like 100 more slides to go. So, what I would suggest is there are these white cards, and somebody make a note of these questions, because I think we have a panel on Friday that these would be really excellent questions for. I don't mean to interrupt the discussion, but we have a packed day today. Kathy, one quick comment.
Yeah. Okay. So, great question, Ava. I totally understand what you're saying. And I would like you and then let me say it part of a response, but we'll follow Clint's direction and cut it off there, is that another thing we did is we took all the flagellar motors in all these different cells that we had, and we cut them out in the tomograms, aligned them, averaged them. And so here are the average flagellar motors from 10 different species. And now we're comparing which genes are in which organisms and trying to figure out what this all means. And the interesting take-home message of it is that whereas the chemoreceptors had a universally conserved architecture, these flagellar motors look as different as a four-cylinder Honda versus a Pontiac V8, you know? And the curiousness of this is, I mean, look at this motor compared to acetonema longum or something. Some pieces are the same. The C ring is always here, and there's this transport ring. It's a AAA ATPase that sits here. But the genes are so homologous that nobody would hesitate, if they had a crystal structure of one, to just do a homology model of all the rest. So you have pieces that are almost interchangeable, and yet when they assemble inside the cell, you get vastly different motors. Okay. So that's one story. The other story is, it took us a long time to get to this. And so had we put our tomograms out there, somebody else would have already done this. So it's, you got to...
I think he may have done it wrong.
That's the conflict. We did it wrong?
No, he may have done it wrong, too, on top of that.
Oh, somebody else might have done it wrongly with our data.
I have been putting tomograms out because people don't know how to interpret the data.
Okay. Let's get right to some technical questions. Enough of the, I'm just seeing what we're going to skip. Yeah, we're going to skip a bunch of stuff and get to something I think that'll be of greater, something we should not miss. Given the limitations of the method, i.e. the missing wedge and the cone, how can one reliably detect heterogeneity? So the case study for this question is going to be this one. The pyruvate dehydrogenase multi-enzyme complex from E. coli. This is a fantastic molecular machine. It has three enzymes. One is called E2, one is called E1, and one is called E3. And together, these things catalyze five different reactions. And it's one of these neat systems where the substrate just gets passed around and everybody does their job. It's like an assembly line. And these things, they couldn't help but crystallize. And so decades ago, there were crystal structures of each of the pieces by themselves. But then everybody got stuck because nobody knew how the pieces were with relationship to each other. There was this so-called ordered model where everybody knows that the E2 core looks like a cube inside. And then the E1s and the E3s are decorating outside of it. And some people thought it was like this. Some people thought it was like just dangling flexibly out on the outside. So we did tomography on this. And so there's one other tilt series in this presentation. These are the gold beads. This is contamination. It's this little cluster of lightly gray dots. That's a protein complex. And that's a protein complex. A lot of you, I know, have seen tomograms like this, but that's what ours looked like. Now, the reconstruction is better. Here in the reconstruction, you see clusters of gray densities. Like, that's one complex. Here's a still slice. Okay, so here's one of those complexes. And remember I told you the E2 looked like a cube in the center. So there's that. And then the E1s and E3s are just dangling on the outside. And so this was nice because there was this internal control that we knew it was a cube, and there it was a cube. So we were able to resolve the independent domains of this protein complex. So then we could take several of them and ask, are they all the same conformation? So here's a volume rendering of one of them. And here these four dots are the inside cube of E2. And here's all the densities around it. Here's another example of a particle with the four dots on the inside and all the densities around it. And here's a third example of the cube inside and all the densities around it. So then what we could do is align them on their cubes and ask, are these other densities always in the same position, or a small number of different positions, or what was going on? So here's the movie. We segment it. We did this a few years ago. And one of the questions was, could we possibly fit the crystal structures in? This is meant to say no. We don't know how to fit the crystal structure in there. We don't even know which ones are E1 and E3. But nevertheless, you see balls outside that are about the same size as these other domains. So now we'll replace them with just red spheres. Red spheres are one particle, green are the other, and blue are the third particle. And the point is that if you align the particles based on their core, the peripheral decorating domains are essentially random. And we think that's the answer. That's it. They're just random. They're tethered. So when we build a model of this thing, here's the crystal structure of the core, and we'll put all the decorations on just one of the corners. There are these peptides that people wondered if they're totally flexible. We think they are. They're just flexible tethers that hold the other enzymes out here in the periphery. And then there's these shuttle molecules that are carrying the substrate, bouncing between the active sites. And the whole thing is just tethered together, and that's it. So how do we reliably detect heterogeneity? In our case, this case, we had a structure that had a known piece that could act as a control for us. So we believe there's heterogeneity because we just believe these densities. You know, we think this is above the signal-to-noise ratio. I'm confident that there's a density right there and not right there. And so we can believe that. And so we align them and show that they're heterogeneous. Now, here are some problems that I've seen. I believe that they're problems. These corners of that molecule are 80 kilodaltons. So, for example, there was a paper published. I'll try not to be so specific that, you know, I'm criticizing something specifically, but there was a paper published where people were analyzing a 150 kilodalton complex that had three pieces. And maybe their microscope is better than ours, but they believed that they could tell one piece was different than the other two pieces, and they believed that they could tell which one was the different one. And each one was 50 kilodaltons. We were unable to tell the difference between like E1s and E3s, and these are 100 kilodalton pieces because there's just not enough information on their shape. The other danger is in this particular study I'm thinking of, they had a field of these molecules, a tomogram of this field, and then they heavily denoised it. Heavily, so that it looked quite a bit different than the original data. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a quick question. Are you referring to the single particle structure? There are actually two. One published in 2001, second one in 2002. There is some controversy, but I think the first one had the E1, E2, E3 complex, so it was a B. Are you referring to that one?
No, thanks. I'm thinking of a tomographic study. Okay. The tomography of a field of small proteins. It's not pyruvate dehydrogenase. That was our example. So it was a field of small molecules, and they heavily denoised it. And then they used a program to search for, they said, program, show us where all of the densities that are the size of the particle we're looking for are. Then they took all of those said, and then they said, now throw out everything that isn't the shape we expect. Three densities. It throw out all the rest that aren't that shape. Then of those that have the shape we expect, are they all in the same configuration or not? I just think that's dangerous because you're going to have a lot of noise in your tomogram. So if you start cherry picking which one you think is the structure you're expecting, and then you say, there it is, we saw it, that's it. Or if you use that and then align a lot of other structures in your tomogram to it, you will get back what you asked for. Alistair.
I think I know the tape that you're talking about.
We're on tape, Alistair.
It's absolutely not comparable to this situation because those tomograms were recorded at 1 micron under focus where you can't see them and you can see the trimer.
Okay.
That's a reliable signal plot. So I think that's a non-issue. Can I have a question about your pyruvate hydrogen ions? I certainly believe the density you pointed to.
Thanks.
My question is, the distribution of these peripheral densities is not uniform, but is their number uniform? Have you counted them?
Yeah. There, if it was fully loaded, there'd be 24. Each corner would have 3. And we see 20, 21, 22. And then there's some ambiguity of what is that one or not. Because I think you saw when the crystal structures were in there, they were not matching the crystal structure. So the shape of our density didn't fit a particular crystal structure. And some were smaller, some were bigger. So I'd say there's significant uncertainty there, but it was around, it was variable, and it was in the 20s, usually.
So close to full occupancy, but not always there.
Yeah, and these are purified. So maybe the you purify for something that's close to full occupancy. Tom. I don't think so. Because, you know, these tethered domains, if they were overlapping, we wouldn't know which one went where. So, yeah. Somebody else?
Same question, because if you want to see 24 and you only see 22, then two of them are stuck together.
Right. Yeah. So we'd want to restrict ourselves. Yeah, so that's fully consistent with what we saw. We saw 20, 21, 22. Please. No. But it's a high defocus, and it's low-pass filtered to the first zero of the CTF. So that's like denoising. But it's not additionally manipulated to try to emphasize particles. So, okay, so what I think, how many people have seen a paper where there was a tomogram with a lot of examples of things? And then somebody said, that one looks like what we think it's supposed to look like. And they cut that out and then either use it as their evidence or they then align all the other examples to it and then say, there it is. I'm going to show you an example. This makes me nervous. It's not wrong. It's just there's a high potential for error. You look up at the sky and you see the stars and people see constellations, but you only see one. There are not two examples of, well, there's a Big Dipper and the Small Dipper. Okay, forget it. Paul, what were you going to say? Okay. Please. Yeah, great. Let's go to that. Well, Clint and Bridget already told me what questions to be prepared for. Yeah, okay.
Next time we're going to automate this talk.
We skip the prospects. One of my questions, well, what does not work? And first of all, I want to get back to the carboxysome story to illustrate your answer. So here, another thing we did is we purified these carboxysomes. Our collaborators purified carboxysomes from bacterial cells. And we tried to get higher resolution data by imaging the purified ones. Here's the tilt series. Here's a slice through the tomogram. Remember I told you that these were protein shells packed with the Rubisco enzyme. Rubisco is another one of these barrels with a hole down the middle. And they're exactly this size. And I think it's really compelling that, yeah, all these molecules are the same size. These are very likely all rubiscos. The other thing we noticed about them is they seem to appear in rows. There's an outside shell, and then there's another inner shell. They come in shells. So why is that? And how do they assemble? So given this, these were early days. One of the things we tried, I'll just let you see this. And the point is, can you see any holes in the center of any of the rubiscos? Do we have the resolution to possibly detect the orientation of different rubiscos? So we thought we'd check. And okay, so the first thing about this that doesn't work is that you miss a whole lot of detail that exists in cells. For instance, when you purify them, none of them have these internal storage granules. You don't see that they're next to these big monstrous storage granules, and you don't see the protein connections that say there's something going on between them. But the next thing that doesn't work is we took the crystal structure of Rubisco and we did global cross-correlation using the program that used to be called MoleMatch. And so we just did a global cross-correlation. Where are all the Rubiscos inside? And we identified the ones that seemed to be the highest hits. And so here's our reference of Rubisco. Here is a side view of Rubisco. Here's a top view. It's a barrel with a little hole down the middle. We picked out all the particles that looked like Rubisco. We took the alignments that MoleMatch spit out. We averaged those particles to see what we got. And this is what we got. So here is the average of all of them. And it looks exactly like Rubisco. And I was pretty excited. Cool. So then we said, well, let's just double check that we're not tricking ourselves. So the next one we played it on was the 20S proteasome. Because the 20S proteasome is also barrel-shaped with a hole in the middle. And so when we searched this for the 20S proteasome, it was full of proteasomes. It reminds me, I think Nico really nailed this years ago with Faces of David, that, you know, this is reference biased in its most beautiful glory. So they say, okay. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means we got to be careful about what we conclude from it.
You know, when you deliberately take the wrong reference, then you get something which is close to the reference.
Right.
Or when you deliberately take the right reference, you should get it right.
Maybe, but we don't know. So then we did the next thing. We said, okay, well, this is dangerous. So, but these are all barrels, right? And the resolution of tomography is not that great, so maybe we... So then we should have tried to... When I sleep at night, Francisco Sturis and I probably still have dreams of RNA polymerase crystals. I don't know if you still do, Francisco, but he and I both worked with RNA polymerase crystals, and I still have these in my dreams.
It's even better than the model.
It's better than the model, right? So I used RNA polymerase, our favorite molecule, and here's the reference, and you get out RNA polymerase. So then the next thing we did, okay, we said, well, look, we still think we can see the hole in it. So how can we do this in a way that's robust and not tricking ourselves? So then what we did is we took individual particles out of the tomogram and said, we'll use those as our references. So here's particle number 20, which is what we made the figure of. It's, you know, it's not looking good. But here's particle number 20 in the tomogram. And then we aligned all the others using it as the template and then averaged them. Oh, by the way, this is XY views, this is XZ views, and YZ views. Each row is the same reconstruction. So then we got something that looked like a barrel with a hole in it. And then we used this as the template for the next round to create a first refined model, and that was about all there was. There, no additional changes happen in second and third levels. And here's the Rubisco reference. And then we took a different particle, and we did the same thing. And we did a third particle, did the same thing. We did 10 particles, always got something that looked pretty much like this. So then we created a super average of all of these results and used that as the template to search for it. And there we got something that looked just like this again. And the point was, the biology question driving all these gymnastics was, why are the Rubiscos in layers next to the carboxysome shell? Is there a specific interaction between Rubisco and the carboxysome shell protein that sticks them together? And so we reasoned that if there was a specific interaction, the Rubiscos would be oriented to the shell protein in the same general way. And so once we felt like we had found the orientations of all of our Rubiscos, we laid that into the carboxysome and asked, are they all, say, pointing towards the shell? And the answer was no. They seemed to be pretty randomly. And then we replaced them with a crystal structure of Rubisco, and they seemed to just be randomly diffusing around there. And our paper said, we did not find evidence that these are specifically linked to the carboxysome shell. We don't know if they are. We just didn't find evidence of it through this analysis. Let's see, so where are we? So does a crystal structure work? So how many people have seen papers where they'll take a crystal structure, they'll search a tomogram, find some hits, take the alignments that they get from that, average it, and show that it looks like the reference, and say, see, those are molecules. Those are those molecules. Now, that may not be wrong. It's just dangerous, is my point. David.
I have a suggestion which actually comes from Craig Ankus, which is that they're doing sort of omit maps.
Yeah.
To this, which is where you take a ribosome and you give it one of the subunits as a search model, and then you get a bunch of hits, and you classify them, and you have the class averages that recover the other subunit that you're expecting.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay. So now there's one other thing. We have 5 minutes left, so I want to hit the most important thing, which is okay. So we're in the middle of the flow, but one of the pitfalls you can fall in is taking everything in your tomogram and averaging it together when it shouldn't be averaged. There are papers out there where people averaged things that shouldn't have been averaged, and that led them to interpretations that are just wrong. Now, the opposite extreme is to believe in too many classes. So another thing that you see sometimes is a tomographic field of things, and then they'll take all of the objects and classify them into 8 different classes, and then one of them has something interpretable about it, and they talk about that one. And that may be right, but it's dangerous, because how do you know which of the classes are the real thing and which ones are the noise that got aligned? And it's the same problem as you get into, I guess, in a lot of single particle analysis. But when you average, this is kind of some basics that need to be appreciated. Let's say we have a tomogram of rubiscos, say, in carboxysome shells, and we cut out each rubisco. And presumably they have different orientations. Okay, each one will have this missing wedge, so in Fourier space. And what we're going to do is we're going to cross-correlate one against the other to find the relative orientation or identify if it's another example of the same particle. So the first particle in reciprocal space, you have data in this region, but you have zeros in the missing wedge. And then you take another particle, and let's say, okay, so it could have a different orientation, but its missing wedge will be the same, data here and missing data in here. You do a cross-correlation between these two, and you get non-zero values in this overlap region, and these are zeros. Now let's say you have the same particle, and the true orientation of the particle is actually that it's rotated a little bit. This rotation is how you align these two. So you cross-correlate this and this. Now you have a smaller overlap region and more zeros. So this may not look as strong. By the way, this is taken from Mike Schmid and Booth. So it might look like this is a weaker correlation than that one just because you have a larger region. Now, the people that write the programs to do this, of course, take this into account, and this needs to be done, that you need to normalize the cross-correlation result to the volume that actually has an overlap. That's point number one. In your cross-correlation function, let's say the denominator is the sum of all the structure factors for this one squared plus the sum of all of them from this one squared. The numerator in this cross-correlation, you don't have to impose a missing wedge because it's zeros anyway, and so you get zeros. But in the denominator, you have to, because what if a very strong reflection is right there? And in the denominator, you include all of the reflections. And it wasn't really part of what could have been seen in the numerator, you get lower numbers. So the people who write this software are all far more knowledgeable about this situation than me. But everybody who wants to do tomography should have this gut understanding of the fact that this missing wedge adjusts the cross-correlation, and there's issues in the cross-correlation. You have to normalize it for the region of overlap that exists in each case. And in the last minute, we'll say that when you average particles out of tomograms, you have to normalize. Let's say in reciprocal space, you have 100 measurements of this structure factor, and you only have one measurement of this structure factor. Well, you can't just add them all, or else this will be 100 times stronger, really more strongly represented than this one. You have to divide by the number of observations of that point that you have. And the way to do that is in reciprocal space. So here's from Mike Schmidt's paper. Here is a particle, and here's four more versions of it with different missing wedges. So you're looking down the barrel in all four, but the missing wedge was in different orientations in each case. If you take these particles and average them in real space, you get this, which is still distorted. If instead you take those same particles, transform them into reciprocal space, average them, taking into account how many measurements are going into each structure factor, then do an inverse Fourier transform, you get a better particle. So that's a better way to do it. Okay, and that's my time. The other answers are on the worksheet.